Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hey, everybody, it's Joe Hackman here on Blog Talk Radio, and today is June 13th, 2012, and I have a kind of a cool episode planned today. It's going to be a better business episode, but first, before I introduce my guests, and my guest, I guess you should say, and co-host, I have to give them a little bit of a shout-out, because as I was logging into Facebook this morning, looking at the feed there, and I saw something from Danny Brown talking about Jenny Dietrich, and I was like, okay, what's this all about? And it was Sisyon. Am I saying that right, Jenny? Sisyon?
I don't know what it is that you're talking about.
Oh, you're about to find out. So this Sisyon, which is a PR and marketing...
Oh, Cision.
See, that's why I'm saying it wrong. Just have to say it right. Cision. So Cision had put the Spin Sucks blog, which is Ginny's blog, at number 10, and Danny was in the list, and your co-author for your book was on the list, and lo and behold, there was our special guest today at number 4 with B2B Bliss blog.
Yeah, very exciting.
That was pretty awesome. So I got two of the Sisyon top 10.
Cision.
Marketing. Cision. you'll get me to say it right before the end. Cision top 10. Blogs, PR marketing blogs, which is awesome. So congrats, guys. So I guess I should say who you are now that I've said this great thing happened today. So so basically, you know Jenny Dietrich. She's a frequent co-host. If you don't, she's the founder and CEO of Armit Dietrich, and she's also the founder of the Spin Sucks blog, which is a kind of a fun blog about the PR industry and marketing and things like that. It's, I think almost anybody who's in business that's not in that industry necessarily would also enjoy the content on there. And our special guest today is actually Elizabeth Sosno. Now, Elizabeth is from a let me give the official part of it. You are a managing partner of Bliss PR. Is that correct, Elizabeth?
That's close. Managing director.
Managing director. Well, that might be a little bit different. So, but Jenny thought that Elizabeth would make a great candidate for a discussion just kind of about business. So Elizabeth is also here with us today. So welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Hi. Well, I've already said hi, but...
That's okay. Say hi again.
Hi again.
So we're going to talk a little bit about business, and we're going to kind of pick your brain, because you know business owners and principals experience a lot of different things, and I think you two, in your experience, I think you bring a lot to this topic. I think the people that you deal with, the capacity you deal with them, you're familiar with the employees, you're familiar with the growth, you're familiar with the communications, so I think you both bring a host of a value to that subject. So why don't we just kind of get a little quick, Elizabeth, since you're new to the program, why don't you just tell us a little bit about your history and your background, just to kind of frame things a little bit.
Sure. Well, I've been with our firm for, I think, 22 years now. So 22 years have seen a lot of different changes within our agency.
Which means, by the way, she was 10 when she started.
Now, that is why I like you.
Family business. You could start, you know, making copies and things.
Carrying special donuts to people. Well,
right.
I did start, and this is a company that my dad founded many years ago. And so when I started, he did have a joke business card printed up for me that instead of saying intern, said gopher. So.
Oh, nice.
I have done every single position in this agency over the years, from gopher right on up. And when I started with the firm a long time ago, we really sold traditional media relations. We wrote annual reports and created events and did what I think most people think of as fairly traditional PR. And over the years, lots of different things happened. We evolved to a very strict business-to-business focus, and we have three sectors we specialize in: professional services, financial services, and healthcare. And in the last 5 years, we've made a fairly significant shift away from just being kind of a traditional PR firm into becoming an integrated marketing communication agency. And we're actually in the midst of renaming our firm to reflect that. So I'd say the most fun and the most excitement we've had in the past few years have been figuring out how can we make digital marketing part of our offering and sell that to the B2B client base, which is traditionally a little bit more conservative and reluctant to tackle some of those kinds of newfangled ways of doing things head on. So that's been kind of part of our journey as a firm and my journey as a professional.
Awesome. Well, I think it's interesting because that course might mirror somewhat some of Jenny's experience. Jenny, do you want to kind of, is that also that direction? If I understand correctly,
yeah,
that's kind of the way that things have evolved for you as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the decision, or how did you pronounce it?
Cision.
I think the Cision top 50 PR marketing blog list is a good indication of that. You know, the agencies that are on there are those that are moving toward less media relations, which is what PR is known for, and more integrated marketing communication, which is measurable. You know, I think Elizabeth shares the same viewpoint that I do in terms of we don't want to do things that we can't measure. And unfortunately, you know, getting your name in the New York Times or in Fast Company is a great ego stroke and it's great for brand awareness, but by itself, it doesn't translate into sales. And so that's what we did a few years ago, too, is really change the philosophy and the business model so that we could focus on the things that were integrated with the things that we were already good at in order to deliver results.
You know, it's almost like I see it more as you guys are part of the, I guess you would call like a disruptive evolution of how a business functions with communications, with marketing. And rather than being on the disrupted side, it seems like it's sort of natural. How big of a role is the traditional PR playing today with all the changes in media relations and everything? Either one of you want to tackle that?
Well, I'll take a pass, Jenny. I think we still have plenty of new clients and prospects who come to us and want to be in the Wall Street Journal. That happens every day still. But what I find has changed, and you can call that disruption or you can call that, you know, the trickle-down effect where we're finally everybody's realizing, hey, something's different, is that they're much more open and willing to have a discussion that extends from, hey, I want to be in the Wall Street Journal, to what else could you do for me? I'm confused, but I'm open to hearing about the possibilities. And so, I don't know, disruption to me feels a little bit a couple of years ago where it still felt dramatic and frightening. And now what I find is people are tentatively, conservatively interested, maybe not in a massive integrated program, but interested in dipping their toe in or trying a pilot program on for size.
I see. So how big of a so let's talk a little bit about how big of a stumbling block crossing that threshold is actually getting into this and actually doing this. Because obviously for your businesses it presented a challenge, but thinking about your clients perhaps even more so. And why don't you start on this one, Jenny?
Well, for us, it wasn't a stumbling block at all with our clients because we had started moving them toward this model before we announced it. So I think it was a good almost 2.5 years that we had been moving our clients to a more integrated approach before we announced it publicly. So for the clients, it wasn't a big deal at all. They were like, that's great. You've already been doing this for us. What I found, though, is that those phone calls of, we want to hire a PR firm, and what they meant by PR was get me in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. Those calls diminished, and the calls that we got instead were, well, I saw the campaign that you did for XYZ company and that you were able to use, you know, social, traditional, and content to really help build their business, and we want that too. So I think a little bit of it was the fact that we had some case studies that we were able to show when we made the quote-unquote announcement. Another piece of it was I just got better at inbound marketing and showcasing the work that we were doing so that people could find it. You know, before the results were stories in the paper, unfortunately.
So I've got a kind of a follow-up, and maybe you can take this one, Elizabeth. So if you were having a conversation and you mentioned inbound marketing and the person in business that, say, this other business, this prospect, you were talking to just kind of looked at you with this funny look like they didn't know what you were talking about, how do you guys or how would you describe inbound marketing to the typical, you know, B2B type client?
Well, you know, it pretty much gets into the idea that you want people coming to you in marketing instead of you having to spend endless hours and running after everybody else. You know, inbound means that they find you maybe on a social platform through a piece of compelling content and still in the kicking it old school kind of way in a conversation. And then they want to come to you online and learn more about you and your company and what you have to offer. For most of our clients, that was a very confusing thing to grasp. And when they finally started recognizing it, they recognized the power of their website and the critical importance of their website to rank well in search. And once people understand that search and the right keywords can mean the difference between your website getting a peak when you're up for contention for business versus not getting a peak, then they're ready to start embracing the idea of inbound marketing and people coming to look at the site.
Very good. Would you add anything to that, Jenny?
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, it's funny, I hear all the time, well, I still close business by looking at people in the eyeballs. And by no means are we saying that this should replace that. You should just integrate it with the traditional ways of networking and doing business, because it allows you the opportunity to have more referrals and more word of mouth and more leads coming in through the web. Then you can take your traditional way of doing things and, you know, network and close the business by looking at the person in their eyeballs.
You've got to start the conversation somewhere, right?
Right.
Well, you got to start the conversation, and the unknown magical elixir that is still, I would contend, the most important part of any new business activity that you ever do is chemistry, which is utterly unpredictable, but can mean the difference between, you know, hundreds and thousands and millions of dollars over time. And some of that has nothing to do with inbound, outbound, anything, but it has to do with being, to me, what is a zipped up professional these days in marketing. You have to be able to consult with them on the things that they're already doing well, counsel them on the things that are coming ahead that they're frightened about, and you know, stay by their side for sort of their current pains and struggles, which may have something to do with what you sell, and frankly, sometimes it may not. It may just be being a good professional friend. So I know that's not completely related to marketing, but we've been in a crazy new business cycle recently, and I'm just continually amazed by how much of this is still, we're all very human, and we want to buy things from people that we believe in.
I actually love this, and I'm glad you went there, actually, because I think chemistry and values and things like that are more important than anything, honestly, when it comes to business relationships. And if it weren't for them, I don't think I would be in business. I would probably be working for someone right now, because quite honestly, after two recessions, it was only that chemistry, it was only those relationships that kept me going, because it certainly wasn't my marketing. That's never been my forte, although I kind of hack my way around a little bit now on blogs and things like that. I guess I do okay. So. But
and I would say too, Joe, just based on conversations that you and I have had in the past, chemistry or lack thereof, I was going to say chemistry on the other side, but I guess lack thereof is just as important too, because if you begin working with a client that you don't have that chemistry with, it's nearly impossible to grow that business and really do good work, because you just don't like working with one another.
or even the values, if the values aren't in check.
Right,
you know, if
right.
They kind of, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's just a lot of types of businesses I just wouldn't feel right about doing business with. Do you guys have a filter for that, Elizabeth? Do you guys have kind of a, these are the types of companies we like to work with, these are our deal breakers, and we won't deal with companies that do X or Y? Or
that's interesting. You know, if you're thinking about companies like companies that sell alcohol or tobacco or things like that, we as a firm haven't really had to deal with that too much because we've been so B2B. There haven't been as many sort of tricky industries or industries that maybe would raise a brow or two. So no, we don't have an organized policy in place. Now, that being said, I think integrity is the most important thing you have to offer as a firm or a you know, a business leader. And so I can really confidently say that if I thought something smelled fishy, I wouldn't do it.
Right. How about you, Jenny? Do you guys have kind of a process for that?
Yeah, not really. I'm the same way. You know, if something smells fishy to me, you know, there's definitely red flags. We were in a new business presentation almost 2 years ago, and there was a major red flag. Lisa Gerber and I left the meeting. We both looked at each other like, what the heck just happened? Because the CEO of the company said to the team, his team in front of us, if any of you screw this up, except to use the F word instead of screw, if any of you screw this up, you'll be fired. And Lisa and I were like, wow, if he's going to talk to his team like that in front of people that he just met, imagine what it would be like to work with him. And that was a huge red flag for us. So we declined the business.
Wow.
But that just comes with experience. You know, I think 5 years ago, I would have taken the business. I would have, my gut would have said not do it, but I would have done it anyway because of, you know, needing the money or whatever it happened to be. But yeah, I think that just comes with experience.
Well, there is that point, that necessity in getting past that level. And it sounds like, you guys probably have different perspectives on that issue, but I think it's an important one to talk about. Maybe there's even some stories to be had here. But when you're kind of growing a new business, obviously, Elizabeth, you have an established business, but you work with clients that might be growing their businesses, I assume, obviously. When you're growing that new business and trying to reach that threshold, what are some of the pitfalls that you guys maybe experienced or saw early on, or your clients see early on, that people might see value in knowing about, and sort of, hey, watch out for this, watch out for that?
Wow, I feel like that could take up the rest of the
time. We'll pick a few of the higher points. How about that?
Well, the first one that popped into my mind, and maybe, you know, Jenny and I could probably go back and forth and trade a few on these, but one that for us is an issue, and it's certainly been an issue for any client, really, be it large or small or just starting out, and it's the gamble that you make as a business leader around capacity. Whenever you grow a business, you reach very quickly sort of threshold moments, you know, the road not taken moments, where you have to decide, should we hire another person? We need this person because they have X capability, or they're located in Y location, or they have experience in this sector, or, you know, they add to the mix of the existing business in a way that you believe would be beneficial for you moving forward. But you may or may not have the dollars to justify that hiring decision, or to broaden it out to hire a group of people. And so you have to kind of figure out, I think, early on as a company, are you the kind of company that's willing to take a bet on those investments in people in advance, say, of winning a piece of business, or to take a bet on hiring that person in hopes that they will help you win a piece of business. And in agency life, it's really very important because you're always hunting for the next client, because agency clients turn over. You hope that you can keep them a long time. And as a firm, we're very lucky to have some very long-term clients. Kind of betting on when you hire people, I think, is is one of the biggest pitfalls. And as a firm, for the most part, we've chosen not to hire in advance of getting a piece of business. There have been a couple exceptions to that rule, but it's very, very risky to do that because you might not get the business. And then, in addition, it could be harmful to the rest of your firm because, you know, you're taking a bet that puts their salary and their bonus a little bit on the line too, right, when you decide to bring somebody else on board before having all of the dollars in-house to justify it. So I think that staffing capacity issue is one that is always kind of a big red flag.
Excellent. Ginny, I'm certain you probably have something to add to that. If not, I also have a follow-up on that.
You know, I would agree with that. And I think that, you know, growing a business is hard because you do have to balance that. And one of the things that I've been really focused on is I'm growing the business this year and, you know, is profitability. And part of profitability means making sure that my current team not only has bonuses and raises and all that earmarked, but also that they're at full capacity. And it's funny because you look at everybody that's at full capacity and then you bring somebody new on who won't be at full capacity. So you have to figure out how long does it take before they're at full capacity? What kinds of business do you have to bring in the door to get them to that point? So there's a lot that goes into it. You know, 7 years ago when I started the business, I had no clue about.
So you just kind of, you had to feel your way through it back then. So, you know, maybe you guys, so knowing as far as on the subject of when to hire, one of the things that I think you guys have both sort of keyed in on is at what point does it actually start to pay off? And I've had clients tell me to varying degrees, when they add an employee, it takes me X amount of dollars. They have to work for X number of days or X number of months to in order for me to recoup that, just that initial investment of bringing on a new employee. Do either of you have an idea or a position on how long that might be in a typical scenario for you? Or?
Well, I mean, it's different for every person, right? Because, you know, they're coming in with unique expectations based on their background and based on what we hope that they would accomplish at the firm. But if I had to draw kind of a rough check-in point, to me, you have a very strong sense within a month about whether or not they're going to be effective. And to, you know, if I were to extend it out a bit more, I'd say that there's a 3-month window to sort of prove your value and be functioning at the highest possible level.
Very
That's
good.
What I was going to say, yes, about 90 days.
About 90 days. Yeah, it's funny because you know, I've gotten literally figures between, you know, 60 days, 120 days. I've gotten a lot of different numbers from different people. Obviously, I guess it does depend on what they're doing, what kind of an industry you're in, what the margins are like, and everything else. But I just think that is an interesting. So the human side of this, the employee resources, the growth, that part of it seems to be really a danger zone. Are there other danger zones? We talked a little bit about clients and culture and that sort of thing. Are there danger zones with clients? Are there clients that are actually could be wrong enough for your business that they could really hurt your business? You know, what should businesses perhaps be looking out for there?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the chemistry thing, you know. And one of the things we hear a lot is, and the reason we get brought into new business pitches is because the big agencies bring in, you know, the top level guys that are polished and have been pitching business for a long time and know how to close business. And they bring in those guys to close the business and then do, you know, the bait and switch where the junior level people are actually the ones working on the accounts. So we get a lot of business because of that, because we don't do that bait and switch. And typically what we do is we'll either bring in the people who will work on the account into the new business pitch, or we'll be very clear about who, you know, what the roles are of the people in the room and what the roles are of the people who are not in the room. And when you start to get into trouble is when you don't have that transparency about it, or when you have a client that says, well, I'm only working with Elizabeth or I'm only working with Jenny, and you know, Elizabeth and Jenny only have 24 hours in the day like everybody else. So So I think that you have to just be really transparent about those things because and set expectations because that's when you start to get into trouble with clients.
Yeah, I think it really boils down to two different aspects, and you alluded to it a little bit earlier, Jenny, when you're talking about profitability. So the two big things that you have to look for, you want to take care of, always take care of your clients. That's the reason that you're in business and the reason you'll stay in business. But you have to think about it from a client service point of view. Are we servicing that client, giving them what they need and what we promised, but at a price tag, frankly, that we can afford as a company? You know, there is a danger very much in professional services and in the agency business to over-service or to, you know, horrors, under-service. And so understanding what the right level of service is to deliver against their needs, but not to put yourself into the boarhouse is really important. So that's kind of thing number one you have to think about. And then the other piece, which is really, really important, is client expectations. What do they hope that they're going to get when they hire an agency? Because marketing still feels, despite the quant that's available from online activity and other places these days, marketing still feels very ambiguous to lots of clients. They don't understand and sometimes think they're, you know, buying this kind of metaphorical black box, and they're not totally sure what's in it, but they think it would be good. And so, you know, helping figure out very early on what they need to consider and what will help make a program successful is important. So, for example, we have a new client diagnostic that we go through with every client, and it has, you know, the questions that we've learned from sort of hard-won experience over time that help us try and narrow in on what they want to achieve, what we think will help them be successful, and it can often highlight some of the red flags that, you know, that may need to be sort of flagged.
Right.
So, you know, yeah. You need some tools to help you figure that out. I don't think it's just experience. I think actually, since it's also ambiguous, it's important to have a little rigor, to have some systems as a company, you know, that you can draw upon.
That's pretty cool. I just had this come to my mind as you were explaining this, and what came to mind is pros manage expectations, because both of you sort of what you're talking about is really along the line of expectations. What can be done, what you would do, who would do it, etc., and really making that process very, very well understood. And I think that's probably a good bit of universal business knowledge, really, because I think any business is going to be perceived based on what they do once they're in that relationship. And if they're not doing sort of what the business, what they, you know, said they were going to do, then that's a real problem. So maybe since you're both really, really, really good at understanding where sort of marketing is today, and this is really your direction, and both of you are doing that, I think I'm going to kind of guide the conversation a little bit more, even more so into that area. Because I think that the two of you cumulatively can really provide a lot of value to people who are maybe just getting ready to take a leap or thinking about this or whatever. What do you think, what types of businesses right now do you think should be looking at inbound marketing to bring in more customers and more opportunities?
Every business.
All of them?
Everybody,
say Jenny. Okay.
Yeah. You know, we work with a company that makes oxidizers. It's a, you know, multi-million-dollar purchase. It's not something you buy online, but we use the web to help answer questions. And, you know, one of the big things around the oxidizers is you have to stay in line with EPA guidelines, and EPA changes their guidelines, you know, arbitrarily like twice a week. And it's really hard to keep up on that. And if you don't keep up on it and somebody from the EPA walks into your plant and your oxidizer isn't at the level that it's supposed to be that week, you get fined in a big way. And so we spend a lot of time educating the purchase decision managers on EPA guidelines and those kinds of things. So they're not going to buy the oxidizer online, but it creates that thought leadership. And we know exactly what people do in order to make a purchase decision, in order to call or request a quote or request more information. We know that those are the three things that trigger that sale. And we push everything that we do online, and it's all through inbound marketing. We do it all through those three things, but they don't actually buy the oxidizer online. They still buy it the traditional way, but it's definitely a way for us to use inbound marketing to get more clients and build their revenue and do all of those things, even though they don't have something that they can just, you know, click and buy online.
So do you agree with that, Elizabeth? Should every business be using inbound marketing?
Well, yeah, kind of, sort of, in a way. I think the beauty of inbound marketing or any kind of online marketing is that you have the power with a keystroke or two to see where your audiences live and breathe and play and talk, and frankly, where they don't, or where they're small groups as opposed to large groups. And so I think Ginny's right in that inbound marketing could work for most anyone, but what I like best about it is that you have the power for no cost but, you know, your hours of labor to do the research to discover, is inbound marketing going to be worthy of an investment of your time? So we have a very large global manufacturer that we're global digital agency of record for. And one of the projects that we had to do for them last year was to take a look for 25 different countries to evaluate what the state of online marketing was for their different audience segments. And what we found at the end of this fairly massive project is we put together a chart that was kind of a red light, green light, yellow light kind of perspective on whether or not we thought online marketing, inbound marketing would work for them. Huh. And, you know, there were a few reds, there were a lot of greens, and there were, you know, a handful of yellows. And what I love about this world that we're now a part of from a marketing perspective is we can tell the client quite specifically, hey, look, our research points to this level of audience participation and awareness. And so, lucky for us, that means you can focus on audience A versus audience B and develop a program that, based on their activity and their preferences, is likely to be a lot more successful and get you the inbound leads that you want. So I think it works for everybody, but my favorite part of it is that the research can help you to exclude or prioritize in a way that significantly ups the chance of the program being successful.
Hmm. That's pretty cool. I like the kind of, it's almost like you're pulling up to a stoplight. Do I want to go or do I not want to go? It's just really simple to describe that. That would be an easy way to understand. So now another big question, I'm sure you guys both get this all the time, is if companies hire your firm for marketing, what should people be expecting as far as a return, and how do you guys quantify that return? Do you do case studies with your clients? Is it just the way that everything's set up, that it's done in such a way that you can actually determine? Or is some of this just done on trust and on a gut because there's really no way of knowing?
Boy, I don't think we do anything on trust or gut. I mean, we look at analytics to death. And when we started doing some of this stuff, especially using the web to measure results, we were very concerned about increasing traffic. And in the last couple of years, we've realized that that's sort of a vanity measurement, increased traffic, because it's great if you have increased traffic, but what are they doing? One of the case studies that we wrote at the end of the year last year was for this oxidizer client. And we were able to track, because of the way we had set up the program, the campaigns, we were able to track exactly where business had come from. And we ended up increasing their revenue by $2.2 million last year just from an integrated marketing communication plan. And it was mostly, it was email marketing, it was content, it was inbound marketing, and some search engine optimization. Hmm. So, you know, we didn't do blogging, we didn't do Twitter, we didn't do Facebook, we didn't do LinkedIn, we didn't do the typical things that everybody says, oh, I gotta get on social media. We didn't do any of that. We really used some of the quote-unquote more old tools on the web to do it, and we were able to increase our revenues by 2.2 just from that campaign we did last year.
Wow. And what was the rough return on investment as far as a percentage, a factor?
Our budget was 100 grand, so whatever that is.
Wow.
Yeah, they're cool. Pretty happy. I can't do the quick percentage in my head.
No, that's very significant.
We're not math people.
Nor am I, and I'm in IT, so go figure. I'm supposed to be into math, but whatever. So how about you, Elizabeth? Do you guys have some models for what people should expect for a return? And then maybe we'll get into the finer details of making sure that they're making the right choices in this area.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I'd say, first of all, is we do all different kinds of quants. So, you know, we have one client where we have customized Excel sheets that are, you know, constantly updating based on the data that's coming in. And, you know, we have another client where we focus very specifically on their engagement click through. So, you know, as Jenny said, traffic is one thing, but did they download the white paper? Did they watch the video? What did they do after they performed those actions? You know, we take a close look at that for one client. But I think what I'd say overall is the most important thing about all this quant is actually to prioritize and to clean up what you give to the client. You know, it could very quickly, forgive the word, become diarrhea. There's lots and lots of data that's mm-hmm. out there. Mm-hmm. And so I think a value add that you have as a professional is to sort through, all right, what are the client's business objectives? What do we want to achieve with the marketing program? And then to create a very specific, very customized, measurable plan to achieve those things. And you get buy-in from the get-go. And then you keep chasing after those data points. If the campaign lasts for, you know, 6 weeks, you're looking at it on a weekly basis, or, you know, rolling it up on a monthly basis, whatever it might be. But I think the one thing that I've seen is that every client is different when it comes to what metrics you pick out. And as long as you don't pick the lame metrics, right, literally pick the likes, which we know isn't really going to advance the cause if you have something on Facebook,
right,
then I think, you know, you're doing a good job as long as you keep it very focused on what the client needs are.
So we alluded to this a little earlier about some of the, you know, the impressions that people get during the process when they're looking to hire a company and that kind of thing. But, you know, let's just give some generic advice to a business that's thinking about hiring a marketing or a PR firm. You both have a lot of experience. You know how things are pitched. And the examples I'm thinking of are asking questions like, well, am I working with you, or who will I be working with, you know, that kind of thing, along those lines. What are some of the top questions people should be asking? How should they be filtering this? Go ahead and start, Jenny, if you don't mind.
So I guess I don't fully understand the question.
So
should they be asking for if they're going to hire a marketing firm?
Yeah, so say I'm a business owner, I want to grow my business, I have some objectives, and I know that I need to get help. So I'm calling on marketing firms to hire them, and I want to make sure I'm asking the right questions.
You know, I think you should be looking for professionals who ask about your business. How do you make money? What's the sales cycle like? You know, how long does it take between meeting a prospect and closing a piece of business? Like Elizabeth, most of our experience is on the B2B side, so those are the kinds of questions that I would ask. You know, what's your sales cycle like? And so I think you want to know that the professional or the firm understands that part of their job is to help you achieve your business goals. And if they're not asking what your business goals are, then they're not going to be able to do that. So those are some of the very first things they should ask you. They also should ask you, you know, what your budget is, because I think that just shows a real interest in the types of things that you can afford. You don't want to have somebody say, well, we think you should do X, Y, and Z and have it cost $5 million. So they should ask you what your budget is. And you should have a budget in mind. You know, don't say, well, what do you think it's going to cost? Because if you leave it up to the agency, they're going to put together what they think you should do, and it may very well be a $5 million campaign.
Sure.
You know, and they should be asking you things like how to, what your priorities are and what you're already doing that's working and those kinds of things. So, I mean, I'll toot your horn a little bit, Joe, in the fact that we have a mutual friend who was interviewing for to help have her website redesigned and programmed and all that stuff. And she talked to four or five different people, including you, and every single one of them told her that she needed to shut her site down and start all over. And you came in and said, these are the things that I really like about your site, and these are the things I would change, and here's why. And she felt so much better about that because you didn't say, well, I didn't design this or I didn't write the code, so I'm just going to shut the whole thing down. And I think that's what people are looking for is, or should be looking for, is somebody who can be a partner with you instead of, well, this is the way we do things and that's just the way it is.
Well, thank you. Do you have anything to add to that, Elizabeth, or any other questions that they should be?
You know, I think Ginny is right. The first thing is always to keep the conversation focused on what you're trying to achieve as a business. But I will say, if I were in the position to be interviewing agencies, given that most marketing agencies are making, you know, fairly big claims about what you should be doing from a thought leadership perspective, how should you be active socially, you know, why, you know, X, Y, or Z piece of content needs to be created to help your company be successful in a given sector, I would want to know that my agency put their money where their mouth is. I would want to know that the agency had well-known and recognized thought leadership to share. I would want to know that the agency leaders are recognized not just within the marketing industry, but within the individual kind of sector industries that mattered. I would want to see a footprint or a trail that demonstrated industry experience over time, because while there's all this newfangled marketing stuff, many, at least from a B2B perspective, many of the industries that we touch are thorny, complicated technical subjects that have evolved over the course of many years. You know, so for example, we have a client who is an accounting firm, and you know, simply put, they couldn't afford to hire an agency who hadn't been sort of closely aligned with understanding accounting issues over many years, or they would be putting themselves in a weaker spot. So I think once you get through that kind of part one discussion that Ginny outlined, there's a part two discussion which says, how does the agency reflect the kind of people I want to partner with, both in terms of how they market themselves and the experience they have that matters to me as a client?
And I would add to that too, which is a very good point. If you're looking for help with things online, if the agency doesn't use the web for themselves, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Minor red flag.
Yeah.
And it's not the cobbler's shoes. It's if you're going to be in this business, and that is your business, you better really be in it.
Yeah, you just can't. You can read all the theory and that you want on how to use the web, but until you actually use it, you don't get it.
Yep.
It breaks my heart a little bit, actually. I have many friends in the industry who are still trying to figure out.
I know.
And it's actually sad. I've there have been a couple of times that I've really felt lost and sad about it. People that I really care about as a professional who are not near retirement, but who somehow think that magically delegating it to a 28-year-old is going to solve their business issues, and it can't happen. I mean, I've given 3 or 4 speeches on this subject, and people still sit in the room and look at me as if they can't wait for the speech to be over.
Right,
maybe,
yeah.
Maybe that's just me.
Train wreck.
It's funny you say that, because I asked a group of my peers, you know, of about 100 people, who's using Google Alerts to track the industry or to track their competitors, and 3 people out of 100 and some odd people raised their hands. I mean, it's just, it's sad to me too. It breaks my heart a little bit too.
Yeah. Well, maybe this brings up a kind of an important topic of just kind of retooling and not being afraid to retool and observing trends and go, you know, sort of making logical decisions based on those trends. How do you personally avoid getting into a rut? As far as it's easy in a business to become complacent. You really have to, it's an active process to not be that way. So do you either of you have some tips? Elizabeth, do you have any tips about how to avoid that rut and to be prepared to constantly retool and adapt?
Well, there are some people who are more inclined towards change than others. And so that's not really tip worthy. I know for myself, I'm excited by things that move and change. You know, the kaleidoscope, and you tilt it just a little bit more and the colors and the shapes all run together in a different way. That's fun to me. So I think organically there are people who are more excited about staying abreast of that change. And organically there are people who are more interested in making the factory run ever more efficiently. And those are two very different kinds of people. But that being put aside in terms of tips, the single most important tip that I can say is to be a reader and to be a consistent reader. So reading is how we all still learn, or maybe we view a video or listen to something like today's discussion. But you have to open up a little bit of your time, and you have to do it on a daily basis to try and stay abreast of what's happening. I don't believe that you have to be online all day long. I haven't been today. But, you know, I put it to a friend recently. They said, how do you do this? How do you stay on top of it? And I said, I'm giving you a 5-minute-a-day challenge. Can you, for 5 minutes, read one piece and engage with one person online? If you did just that, if you spent 5 minutes on two actions, but you promised yourself that you had to do it every day without fail, at the end of, you know, I would argue even a month, you would see a meaningful uptick in, you know, just staying on top of change and what it might mean for your company.
Anything to add, Jenny?
You know, I was going to say the same thing. There are some people who like change and some people who don't. And there are some people who are really inclined to continue learning and some people who are not. So I think Elizabeth and I both fit into the more inclined to keep learning segment. And it's the same thing for me. You know, right now I'm trying to figure out mobile because I know that's the next big thing. And I want to make sure that I understand it so I can coach and mentor my team, who can then coach and mentor the clients. So it's really important to me that I understand those things before I implement them into my agency.
So as leaders then, because obviously I'm assuming you both are involved in making decisions. Well, I know you are, Jenny, in who you work with, and I'm assuming you are also, Elizabeth. Human resource-wise, what do you guys do to sort of make sure that your employees are geared towards the right? I mean, we talked a little bit about the screening process, but is there sort of key characteristics that you're looking for in your candidates for jobs? And do you go in with a really clear sort of purpose? Hey, look, this is what I need. This person exhibits those skills. This is going to work because of that.
I have some very clear ideas, and I've actually blogged a fair amount on this subject too. There's at least a couple of posts on our blog, and I think another one I did for Jay Baer also, all touching on this. But in a nutshell, we want to hire someone who is curious and smart and also kind, because you know, the other piece of all of this is you want to be in an environment where people treat each other with kindness and are basically good team members to each other. But the curiosity piece is the most important thing. You want someone who's ready to turn over a lot of rocks, figure out how things work, and that's hugely important. From an agency perspective, I am a passionate, zealot nut about the fact that I do not believe that PR and marketing firms should have a digital division. And that there's somehow this special little playground where the cool kids get candy and ice cream and lollipops, and then the other professionals kind of like toil away getting the other work done, the uncool work done. I think my obligation as a boss and my partners too is to promise all of our folks that even though they may be at different learning curves, that everybody is going to get continual, consistent training and support in terms of becoming a well-rounded professional, because that's good for them and that's good for our clients and it's good for the firm. So, in the last few months, we've done trainings and discussions around Google Insights, around, you know, what's the latest thing with analytics. We did a webinar on mobile for all 43 of our employees, and we bring in outside speakers, and we have, kind of regular inter-team training sessions where if one team knows something that they can share that's helpful for another team, we put that into place. But I think the most important thing is if you hire really smart people and then you continue to give them and fill their brain with new and challenging things, you get a really good outcome. If you force people just to stay in one area, no matter what area that is, you sort of stunt their growth.
Ginny?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. We look for curious, that entrepreneurial spirit, the motivated to do some learning on their own as well. Even though we also have formal training and professional development, I want to see that people are willing to take it to the next level and do some of that stuff on their own. Reading books, reading blogs, subscribing to magazines, those kinds of things. There's almost nothing more pleasurable from a work perspective than going into a staff meeting and having somebody say, hey, I read this book on whatever it happens to be, and I'd like to have a discussion about it. I think that's fantastic, because early in the business, I was the only one that was reading books, and I'd say, hey, you guys should read this and check this out. And it was really hard to bring them along, but I learned to find the types of people who are already curious about that, those kinds of things.
So some new interview questions perhaps to include in your repertoire. What magazines do you subscribe to? What's a book you read recently? Things like that. It's interesting. Those are minor things, but yet they do say a lot.
Yeah. I'll never forget. I've always asked in interview questions, who's your favorite fiction author?
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny to get people's responses to that. Oh, I don't read fiction. Or somebody told me Danielle Steele, and I was like, you're not getting a job.
Oh, no. No, that's horrible.
Yeah, I was like, nope, next.
Oh, man.
Well, so, Ginny, who's your favorite fiction author? Now you have to say.
I have so many. I mean, George Eliot, all of the classics. I'm rereading A Movable Feast right now. Toni Morrison, I love. So yeah, I mean, I'm a literature major, so I have a ton.
Me too.
I know.
And I did a senior year on Toni Morrison, so we could talk about that sometime.
We should. I need to read her new book.
We will.
So,
hey,
but,
and you know what, Joe? I just want to add a postscript to this.
Yeah.
If folks are listening to this and they want to think about reading and preparing for interviewing, do your homework. I am perpetually amazed by how many people come in for interviews and they haven't done a deep dive. It's crazy. If we have a blog with hundreds of entries, and nothing is easier than pulling up and finding out what we think on a topic. Yet most people don't take the time to read more than, the post that's on the website that day. It's scary.
It is scary.
That is scary. And also, I think from the perspective of even when you go to talk to a client or a prospect, I should say, to try to have a little bit of groundwork on that. A little preparation goes a long way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, some of them are easier than others. Obviously, I could learn a lot about the two of you and your businesses very quickly online. But I could understand others being a little bit more difficult. But if you're easy to find and people aren't bothering to take the time, then that says a lot.
It does say a lot.
So, Well, this is, you know, I can't believe it's been almost an hour already. We're actually running out of time, which I never ran out of questions. I probably had 50 more things I could have asked you guys. But, you know, it's interesting, this conversation really did end up being a little bit more geared towards what you both do, but I think that's where you guys can really help people the most anyway. So I'm grateful for your time invested in this. And it was very interesting for me to hear your perspectives.
That was usually, sometimes, Elizabeth, just so you know, Joe and I struggle a little bit to get through the full hour, so that was very, very good.
Well, depends on the topic.
Yes, the topic sometimes we're like, okay, what do we talk about now?
We had a couple that fell flat.
Yeah.
You can talk about it for about 45 minutes. Now Jenny and I can talk about things for as long as we need, you know, as long as we had time to talk about. But when it comes to one individual topic, sometimes it is a struggle to keep the conversation going more than 45 minutes or so. But this was a wealth of information. So congratulations again for your recognition today. And I know it's you guys are both, when I was researching for this, you guys are both, of course, great panelists for this particular topic. So thank you very much again for your time.
Well, thanks, Joe.
So
that
where,
was fun. Thanks for including me.
You're very welcome. So where can people find you if they didn't figure it out already, if they're still listening and they want to know where to learn more about you or your company?
Well, you can find me at our website, blisspr.com. On Twitter, you can find me at Elizabeth Sosno. And I don't think I'll go through all the social platforms. I'll just leave it there for today.
Fair enough. And Jenny?
Easiest place for me is spinflex.com.
Awesome. Well, hey, you guys have a great day, and thanks for everyone for listening. There will be an episode summary loaded up on my blog tomorrow at joesgonesocial.com, and I'm at HackmanJ on Twitter. Thanks for listening.